Hello and welcome to the Insight in Focus podcast. My name is Pamela Hillig. I'm an actuarial manager at Insight Life Solutions. And today we have an episode of the Open Books podcast, where we get to know fascinating and inspirational people in the industry through the books they know and love. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by the marvelous Marjorie Ngwenya. Marjorie serves as an independent non-executive director to the financial services and not-for-profit sectors. She's also an external member of the Prudential Regulation Committee of the Bank of England. And most of us, I guess, in this audience will know her as past president of the Institute of Faculty of Actuaries in the UK. She was the first person of colour to hold office in the organization's 160 years. Also, its youngest, and I believe its third female president, from what I remember reading. And in her executive career, Marjorie led actuarial strategy and risk management teams. And through her work as a leadership and life coach, she now demonstrates her passion for personal growth, which has culminated in her recently published book called Empowered Evolution, all about shaping your mindset, discovering your meaning, and thriving with momentum, which we'll definitely talk about more. But welcome, Marjorie.
Thank you, Matt.
So Marjorie, tell me, are you a reader?
Very much so. I've always loved reading.
So glad to hear that, because this podcast is a bit different from other interviews you might have done before, in that we'll talk about you and, you know, your experience and what you're busy with at the moment, interspersed with conversation about books that you've read and have really shaped you in some way. So you can think of it as the desert island disc for bibliophiles. But before we get into the books, let's talk a bit about you. Tell us about the things you're busy with at the moment.
So I'm currently doing a bit of a portfolio career. I do some freelance consulting. I have some non-executive director roles and board advisory positions, as well as running a coaching practice and doing some writing.
And in between that, you have time to read?
Reading a fair amount, because I travel quite a bit. I tend to read on the go. And when I'm home as well, I like to get some downtime.
So yeah, before we get into the first book, let's talk a bit about your reading habits, which I'm always curious to hear more about. So you say you've always loved reading. Do you remember when you started reading and how that love came about?
I was an early reader. I think I was about four, and I was trying to keep up with my older sister. I was fascinated by books and ended up memorizing my first one. Now, to be fair, it was a very straightforward book. And as a junior school student, I had a library book allowance of four books a week. And my parents had to write a letter to the school to increase my allowance to six books because I just devoured them. And I loved mystery stories in particular. So Nancy Drew or The Famous Five were good staples.
And do you still like that kind of mystery spy genre, or what genres do you read these days?
Every now and again, I dig into that genre, but I'm more into personal development books nowadays.
Okay. Reading and writing them?
Yeah.
And can you describe your perfect reading setting?
On a beanbag, near a window with lots of sunlight streaming through the windows and a beautiful view of the nature beyond. I am also partial to reading in bed every now and again, which is an occasional pleasure.
Okay. Do you like to snack while you read?
Not so much. So not typically, but occasionally I do. And if I'm reading something lighthearted, I might have a snack. Crisps are my guilty pleasure. I definitely prefer a savory snack over a sweet one. And depending on the time of day, I might have a cup of coffee or tea or a glass of wine.
Sounds idyllic. All right, so let's get into the books. And because you are traveling, we don't have the physical copies with us at the moment. So I've printed out the covers to give people a bit of a visual aid. Can you tell us about the first book you've brought along metaphorically today?
So the first book I brought along is called A Course in Miracles, and it's a bit of a spiritual text. It's a book that I discovered about 5 years ago, and it has been such a revelation for me in terms of displacing fixed ideas that I have about the world.
Do you remember where you were when you first read it?
I was at home in George, where I was living at the time, and it was during the pandemic, so just over 4 years ago. And I just remember thinking, wow, what's it like? And I'd heard about it through other texts I was exploring, so other authors that I admired, so Wayne Dyer, Marianne Williamson, and they kept referring to this book. And I thought, I wonder what it's all about. And if it's inspired their writing, I really want to know more about it.
So it's A Course in Miracles written by, am I pronouncing it right, Helen Schuckman?
Yes. So she was actually a scribe for this book. And it's difficult to explain, but let's just say she was inspired to write it. These are not her own words, per se.
And what is the key message of the book?
So the key message of the book is about how to seek out peace and how to live in a space of love rather than fear. And it's a book that's been very helpful for me in navigating life. It's something that continues to teach me and remind me that we create our own so-called realities, and we place a lot of weight on things that are temporary. And it just encourages us to take a step back from the world and to focus a little bit more on what's going on internally.
I can tell some of those themes you explore in your book as well.
Yes, indeed, I do.
Okay. And I always ask, you know, to if you can read a favorite quote you have from your book. So what's the quote you'd like to read from this one?
My favorite quote would be, what you think you are is a belief to be undone. You are
taking a moment
you
to
are your thoughts. And your beliefs are not fixed. They're not permanent. They're simply a story we tell ourselves, and we can change that story anytime we like.
Liberating.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I encourage anyone who wants to explore the expansion of their mind and their spirituality to read it. For some people, it's controversial because it's something that they can't seem to put alongside whatever spiritual belief or religious belief they may practice. But I'm of the view that many spiritual beliefs can coexist. So I accept it's not for everyone, but I draw a lot from it.
Great. And perhaps if we can talk a bit now about the role that probably, you know, brought you into my realm. Although I think there was a role before that. You were editor of the Actuary magazine.
Yes.
Am I correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Yes. So I remember knowing you from then. But you speak in your book about, you know, being elected as president of the Institute and Faculty of Actuaries in the UK, as we said, you know, breaking many records in the process. So can you tell us what it was like being president of the IFA, and how did holding that position serve your life and your career goals?
It was both challenging and enjoyable. So in the run-up to being elected president, that position or holding that position was so far from my mind. I'd always imagined that this is a role that people would occupy at the end of their careers. Typically, presidents were coming up to retirement, and typically presidents did not look like me. So it was far from my imagination that that would be a role I would occupy at that time in particular. And so I had been on council for a number of years, and I'd been a volunteer for the profession. I was very comfortable in that space, and it was a role that I thought I would like to play eventually. But I had a real sense of imposter syndrome when I was told that I'd been nominated for the position. And I thought to myself, but why? Why would anybody want me to be president? And I had to let go of that idea that I didn't belong there or I wasn't deserving of it, and recognize the fact that my peers had nominated me. They'd seen something and clearly they felt I was capable. So why did I have such doubt about it? And even going into the election process, I kept thinking, the person I'm up against looks and sounds like the typical president. So, you know, I'm going to give it my best shot, but let's see, because it's an outside chance. And I was successful. And I think it just speaks to various episodes I've had in my life around doubting what I'm capable of doing and doubting where I belong. And imposter syndrome is something that's quite pervasive. I think it affects many, many people, and not all of us talk about it. And the way that I have learned to overcome that is to think about what are the facts and what is fiction? What am I making up in my head that actually isn't real? And what are the things that I can count on as being true? So others' perspectives and feedback on my ability give me a sense of, yeah, I can do this. My own proving to myself things that I've done in the past give me a sense of, yes, I can do this. And so I try and center in those things rather than the doubts, which can really become all-consuming. And that chapter was really quite challenging in terms of just juggling everything that was going on in my life at the time. When I first started, I was in a full-time job on a different continent, flying between South Africa and the UK, which was taking its toll on my body. Eventually, I decided that I would step aside from my full-time job and focus on my presidency. And through it all, I learned an incredible amount. I was stretched. I was placed in many different political and stakeholder management scenarios that I think were very, very helpful in growing me.
So what does the president do? What were some of your highlights during your presidency?
The president essentially chairs council. It's probably one of their primary functions. So they're steering the group that decides upon the vision and strategy for the organization as things stand. There is a governance review underway. And the president has to manage a number of stakeholders, including the management board, which consists of some independent members and also the executive team, and all the relationships that come with the volunteer roles that other members play as well. But the president doesn't operate on their own, so they're very closely working with the chair of the management board, with the chief executive officer, and with the other members of the presidential team, so the president-elect and the immediate past president. And it's sort of divide and conquer job, literally, where you have different responsibilities. I was liaising primarily with our members in Africa and India, and other colleagues were doing their roles in different parts of the world. And so it meant going to visit our members there, attending conferences, doing talks, and just being involved with all of the initiatives the IFRA had ongoing.
I wanted to pick up on something you said earlier where, to address or to kind of confront your imposter syndrome, some of the things you do are listen to feedback from your peers and people you respect, and also looking back on, your own achievements and things that you have actually managed to do. So how does one, and, you do touch on this in your book as well, if you do receive criticism from others or if you do fail, how does one not let those things kind of undo the good work you've done to confront that imposter syndrome?
Great question. Well, I guess the realization is that all of us are imperfect in our own ways. We don't know everything, or we don't know how to do everything. And so there are going to be some points of feedback we're going to receive, and we should be open to those. So a trusted friend once told me that I overdo the feedback, that I am almost looking so hard for the things that I'm not good at that I forget the things that I am good at. So there is a balance to it. And so I would say, listen out for things. Because if one person is telling you something, maybe they're right, but maybe they just had a bad day. Right? If two or three people have shared with you the same feedback, and maybe you need to go and dig around a little bit to see whether this is true and something you need to look into, or whether it's something that is just one person's opinion and you can live with that. And sometimes, often I would say, we have a sense of our own capability and a sense of our own ability to do something or to be skilled at something. So if someone says to you, well, Pam, I really think that you could speak with your direct reports a little bit more kindly, chances are that you would have a sense that actually, I was a little harsh, or I tend to be this way when I speak to them, and maybe I could change my style a little bit to get the best out of them. So if the feedback does not resonate at all, there's something more to be explored. If it rings some bells, then put the pride aside and go, okay, maybe I could do this better. What is the best way forward?
And I like the way you speak about it. There's almost that detachment between the feedback and, you know, your value or your intrinsic value as a person.
Absolutely. We are not what other people think of us. And I think this is a mistake that I made often in my early career. I internalized everything, everything personally. And your value is not determined by what other people think about you or say about you, in fact. And in the book, I talk about people calling you things. So if somebody said to you, you know, Pam, you are a blue submarine, you'd probably laugh and think, are they crazy? But if somebody called you a really selfish daughter, you'd probably take that to heart. And the only difference between those two things are the words that they've used. Does it make them true? Not necessarily. As I said, there may be some truth in the feedback we receive, but somebody's label and what someone believes of you doesn't make it true. And it does not determine your value.
At note, let's talk about the second book you've metaphorically brought today. And that is The Courage to Be Disliked by Ishiro Shimi and Fumitake Koga.
That's right.
Apologies for the pronunciation.
That's right.
So tell us, what is this book about?
This book is about recognizing the things that belong to you and the things that belong to other people. So it's actually a nice way to affirm what we've just been talking about. And this is a book that has offered me several lessons. And one of my favorites is the idea of being responsible for yourself first, and that your life is the sum of your choices. I have in the past rescued loved ones and overstepped boundaries. And this is very much a reinforcing idea in the book about how to recognize what is yours to do and what is for others to get on with.
And I think that also touches on your, yeah, another theme that comes up a lot in your work is, you know, that importance of authenticity.
Yes.
And staying true to yourself, even in, you know, difficult situations, because there is such a human instinct to want to be liked and to belong and not to be kicked out of the tribe, right?
Yes, exactly. And we place a lot of weight on that. To our detriment, I think we end up being steered by what others perceive about us, and we end up living other people's lives instead of the ones that we genuinely want to live.
And do you remember how this book, The Courage to Be Disliked, came into your life and where you were when you read it?
Once again, I was at home in Georgia during the pandemic, and so about 4 years ago,
reading
it was, it really was. And I don't remember how this book was introduced to me, but I just remember thinking, I'm really stimulated by the title, The Courage to Be Disliked. That sounds like something that I could get on board with. And I had a sense that it would be about being authentic, but I just had no idea the number of layers it had and the way that it related the story. And so this is a book that I really connected with, and I would encourage anyone who wants a reminder or a lesson in self-accountability in its broadest sense to pick this up and give it a go.
With these types of books, you know, that you read, said that you're reading these days, development and kind of self-help, self-improvement, whatever you want to call it, how do you internalize the lessons and remember them and apply them instead of just, you know, kind of reading and you know, enjoying it at the time, right, appreciating it, that kind of goes in one ear out the other?
So I find that I have to reread books, and I highlight things that I find really, really pertinent. And then I go back and think, okay, so why did I highlight this? What does it mean in the context of my life? And I particularly like books that have reflective questions at the end of a chapter or an exercise they're asking you to do, just embed the learning. And so I don't think that we can learn everything that a book has to offer in one go. That's just my sense, and that's been my experience. And so going back, sometimes I have a book on repeat because I listen to a lot of audiobooks. Sometimes I just have them on repeat. And each time I listen to it, I learn something different, or I think about it from a different angle, or something recent has happened where I can really connect the content with that instance and think, okay, could have done better there, or that's what was going on. And it just reveals a whole new aspect of understanding.
I find it kind of speaks to that saying, I think it's attributed to Confucius, where he says, I hear, I forget, I see, I remember, I do, and I understand. And when I was reading your book, there were so many things that I'm kind of working on at the moment that I could apply, you know, your teachings to, which I feel made the concepts cement a bit better. And, you know, you also had the worksheets or the questionnaires at the end of each chapter to make it even more practical and you know, true to my own experience. So,
yes.
Yeah, so I agree with that. Can you read us a quote from this book that you enjoy?
Yes. A healthy feeling of inferiority is not something that comes from comparing oneself to others. It comes from one's comparison with one's ideal self. So again, speaking to the idea that your idea of your shortcomings or your worth should not be about, oh, Marjorie is this relative to Pam. It should be Marjorie is this relative to Marjorie's version of her ideal self. And how does she strive to become that person? What are the lessons she needs to learn? What is the growth that she needs to undertake? And I really love that. It just takes away all the outside noise and says, focus on where you feel you need work and where you need growth and compare yourself to that rather than getting lost in what others have or what others do, which really has nothing to do.
So you've worked all over the world. Can you tell me a bit about the various places you've ended up in and how? And then perhaps segueing into how you went from a more traditional actuarial executive career to a portfolio approach.
Sure. So I was born in the UK, raised in Zimbabwe, and then moved to the UK as a high school leaver, ready to start university. Spent 16 years, I think, in the UK. And in the middle of that stay, I spent time in the Netherlands. I was on secondment there, and I was also on secondment in Canada, in Toronto. And then I moved to South Africa after spending time in the UK. And I'm now in the middle of another move, but more about that another time. And those moves have come about opportunistically, you know, they've mostly been job related, but also lifestyle related. I'm somebody curious and I'm somebody who likes to explore different environments and cultures. I was very keen to go on secondment to the places I mentioned and put my hand up for the opportunities. And then my move to South Africa was really about thinking, I've always had this idea that I want to try and work in Southern Africa, so close to the home that I was raised in. And I was very, very hesitant because South Africa does not have the best reputation for security, physical security. And I was always anxious.
Nice way of putting it.
And you can get caught up in the hype because it really is hyped up. And, you know, even as somebody who had visited the country often, I still had a nervousness about relocating there. And I had to get beyond that and see all the other benefits that the country can offer, and a great career, weather, lifestyle, wonderful people, beautiful nature, and all those things in the end outweighed this hesitation and fear that I had. And yeah, it was an incredible experience, very, very enlightening and a great chapter of life. Then coming to the transition from my executive career to this more portfolio approach, it was sort of accidental, really, in the sense that it was sparked by my transition into the presidency of the IFOA. And if not for that, I probably would have put it off for much longer. Now, let me rewind a little bit and share that early on in my career, I had this sense of disconnect that I was not doing what I really wanted to do. I was doing what I felt I had to do. And I stepped into the actuarial profession, not really understanding what it was, but I'd grown up in a home where my parents had insisted that we follow a profession. And I didn't want to become a doctor because my sister was becoming one. Most of my friends were becoming accountants, and that just sounded boring, which is ironic for an actuary. And I had no idea what the actuarial profession was about, but I knew that it was apparently very difficult to pass the exams. And that for me was hugely stimulating. I thought, well, you know, apparently there were 5 qualified actuaries in Zimbabwe at that time. And I thought, if they can do it, so can I. Off I go. But when I was in the job and doing the exams, I kept thinking, this is really not me. And why am I here? But I couldn't let go of that sense of duty. I'd started something and I needed to continue it. And I had ingrained in me this idea that being part of a profession was the height of professional liberation and success. And so I just kept going. And this is not to say that it was a bad road to go down. It's just to acknowledge that I felt the sense of disconnect early on. And so when I had the opportunity to do something different, it was incredible. It was liberating. It was a response to this call that I'd been ignoring for so long. And I said to myself, well, you know, worst case, you're just taking a break for now. You're attending to the presidency. You'll find projects to keep you entertained and keep you paid. And you'll figure it out afterwards. And it's actually just turned into a way of life now that I enjoy the variety of things that I'm busy with. I enjoy the flexibility. And I don't know if I could go back, actually.
I think what you've said has probably resonated with so many actuaries who may be listening to this, you know, step for step, you know, that challenge of being, of doing something that everyone says is the hardest thing in the world, and then being in it and realizing that you don't enjoy it, but you have to carry on, you have to finish it. And then I think what happens for a lot of people is you know, start your career, and then, you know, there's the golden handcuffs dilemma where, you know, you want to leave, but you don't want to give up the comforts, or you're not sure what you would do. And I think what people can learn from you is that, you know, be open to opportunities and take, you never know where they're going to take you. They may take you out of a career that you're not enjoying, you know?
Exactly. And I think the first step is just the admission, the self-admission around, this is not where I'm feeling most fulfilled, because that kickstarts everything else, the process of thinking through. So what are my options? You know, am I going to do this for a time? Is it going to be the next 5 years? And then I'm planning for the what's next. Or am I going to say, well, you know what, tough. I've got a family and a mortgage and school fees. And this is just it for me now for the rest of my life. That is a choice too. And many people make that choice. That's okay. But it's to say that there is a different way of doing it. And what I've found is if we let go of the things that we think are fixed and are holding us, then we start to imagine a different future. So when I made this transition, I moved from Johannesburg to George. I stepped out of the noise and I was living a very noisy lifestyle. First of all, I was flying all over the place and I was exhausted. And then every spare minute I had, I was either working in the gym or in some kind of social setting. There was no capacity for thinking, for slowing life down, for doing anything different, because I was just stuck on this treadmill, this hamster wheel of doing it all over again the next day. And so for anyone wanting change in their life, create the space to think. Create the space to just stand still and reflect. And it's incredible what arises from that. It could be half a day. It could be, I'm just going to take half a day of work and go and spend a quiet moment in a coffee shop with some earphones on and just see what comes. Or I'm going to take a walk by the beach or go on a hike. Just create the space. And it's incredible what arises.
And I think, you know, an idea that you mentioned in your book, which so resonated with me and which, you know, people might bear in mind when they're doing this reflection is, and I'm paraphrasing, but something to the effect of, you know, you used to think that if something can't be worthwhile or valuable if you're enjoying it, it kind of has to be a slog to be worthwhile, right?
Yes. And that's a false belief. And we tell ourselves a lot of stories. So for lots of people, the idea that they can get paid to do what they love will sound foreign. I'm probably swearing at them right now as they listen to this, because they don't want to imagine a world where that's possible. It is possible. It doesn't come magically. It does take work. But it is possible to do what you love and get paid for it. And many of us don't know what it is that we love. And that's why the space is important to figure that out. When we're kids, we are so immersed in everything we enjoy. In fact, we pursue enjoyment. It's just a way of being. And then we learn responsibility. And then we learn how to look good and to be rewarded for being good. And we forget what we enjoy. And so for many of us, there's a process of rediscovery of who we are and what we read and really love.
And I wanted to ask, based on all the places you've lived and spent time, where do you feel most at home in the world?
For me, home is probably about people. and rather than places. And there are many places in the world where I have loved ones that when I'm there with them, it's just magic. So one place is the US where my husband is, Amsterdam, where I have really good friends and I've spent time as well. And Zimbabwe will always have a special place in my heart. And South Africa, I have probably the highest concentration of people in South Africa. And so for me, that will always be a place that I feel I can go back to and just be.
You're welcome anytime if I have anything to do with it. Well, the next book you brought along is A Fine Balance by Rohinton Mistry. So can you tell us what's this book about and why do you love it?
Oh, this is a beautiful, beautiful book. And what it really brought out to me is the power of prose. It is so well expressed and it's a powerful story about changes in Indian society from independence in the late 40s to the emergency declared by the Indian Prime Minister Indira Gandhi. And for me, the book is about learning to strike a balance between hope and despair. And it's wonderfully written. It intertwines the stories of different people from very different socioeconomic backgrounds and just weaves it so beautifully to tell this story. And I don't want to give anything away, but I would encourage this read. If you're looking for something well written, something very emotionally provocative, I highly recommend.
So would you call it a historical novel? Are the individual stories fictional?
They're fictional.
Real life.
And to my knowledge, it's a fictional story, but it's centered around real life events. And so that's what makes it powerful. But even if you didn't know the history, that doesn't matter because the stories are incredible. And I remember weeping towards the end of this book and just thinking, oh my goodness, why? Why does it have to be so?
And do you have a favorite quote from this book?
I do. The human face has limited space. If you fill it with laughter, there will be no room for crying. Simple, but effective.
Yeah. Gosh, and if the whole book is like that, I definitely need to add it to my TB.
Yes, do and let me know.
I will. So I know you have a strong interest in diversity and inclusion. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that. And specifically, you know, what are some of the things that could have been done in your career or in your life that would have made you feel more included?
Great question. So I have to say that in my earlier career, I did not identify overtly anyway as a Black female. I just was a professional doing their thing in the world. And particularly in the UK, where the conversation around race at that time was not very overt, it wasn't something that I felt I needed to highlight. That's not to say I didn't have experiences that had me feeling, is it because I'm different? But if somebody asked me, you know, how do you get on at work? What are your challenges? I don't think that I would have pointed to anything around my ethnicity or race being a factor. And in fact, I would have said something around my gender or my age being more of the things that had me clashing with people or had me feeling different or apart from others. Fast forward to South Africa, where everything is about race. It was a rude awakening. And I couldn't adjust to this new frame of thinking for a very long time. And I think I still struggle with it, particularly because when I look like a Black South African female, I'm not. And so there was this friction. I look the part, but I don't count as the part because I don't qualify for EE or anything like that. And I am simply a foreigner. And that was an interesting adjustment as well. What could have been different in my career? I think I would have welcomed more open conversations about difference earlier on in my career. I would have welcomed the spotlight on difference being positive, and certainly cognitive difference being a huge benefit for any organization to enjoy diverse thoughts in decision-making and in innovation. And these are now conversations that I very much embrace and enjoy. I think I would have enjoyed having lessons around what it feels like to be excluded, and therefore what we all need to do to help each other feel included, regardless of our ethnic backgrounds, genders, disability, whatever the case may be. And so this is work that I find really interesting nowadays.
And are those kind of activities or actions things that you do get to influence and implement in the work you do?
Yes, they are. Some of them indirectly, so just by practicing what I believe, but also some of them more directly. So I get involved in conversations and organizations about culture and about initiatives that seek to level the playing field and speak specifically to how you can create diversity. So you can have all kinds of targets about how many people you're going to get through the door and how representative your workforce is going to be. But if you're not having the difficult conversations about how people are excluded once they get there, and all that hard work you do about getting them through the door is pointless in a way, because people will not stay where they don't feel welcome. And I love the analogy around having a body part transplanted. If you want a new heart and your body is not ready to accept that heart, you haven't done the prep work to have that heart being accepted, it will be rejected by a body. And so lots of organizations have work to do around creating environments where people can feel welcome, feel like they belong, feel like they're heard. And even the best organizations, I think, have work to do. We all have work to do. And environments are built by the people in them. And so we all have work to do.
And it, I guess, like an organ transplant, it's not just, you know, one-off thing. Once the, you know, once you have the successful operation, off you go. It's, you know, every day, constantly being aware of it.
Exactly. And if you're not aware, it's difficult to bridge those gaps. So if you're not getting feedback from people about their experience within the organization, or you don't have any kind of data or touch points about what's not working, it's very difficult to remedy it. And so you have to be tuned in, and you have to want to hear the answers, because they're not always easy to hear as well.
So what do you think is the first step for organizations wanting to improve, you know, their feelings of diversity and inclusion?
Oh, tough question. I would say stock take. Understand where you are now, because it's difficult to gauge whether you've made any progress if you don't know where you stand today.
Yeah, very actuarial, you know, benchmark or baseline.
That's right.
And take from there. So your next book is Letting Go by David Hawkins. What's this book about, and why do you love it?
This book is about the power of letting go and surrendering. It's about creating space and practicing this principle of non-attachment, which is somewhat spiritual, I think. And it's such a simple concept in theory, but it's so, so hard in practice. And I love this book because it constantly challenges me to let go of things that I might be holding on to. And that largely is around my interpretation of situations. So sometimes I find myself stuck on something that's happened, and I find myself reliving the experience or having strong feelings about something that happened a long time ago and it was done. And the people involved probably do not recall it, but for whatever reason, it stayed with me. And then I have to challenge myself, but why am I still carrying it around? Because it's just a weight. It's not helping me in any way. So how do I just give it up? And sometimes I visualize the actual letting go of the emotion. And on other occasions, I think about, well, what is it that really hurt me in that situation? Was it because whatever someone said or did touched a nerve because it was so close to my truth? And that's a truth that I don't want to examine. And so whenever I have a situation that keeps coming up, this book is really helpful. And just stop, distill, let it go.
Was this also a pandemic read?
This was just before the pandemic, I think. But it is a book that I've kept reading through the pandemic and beyond. And I have this book on Audible. And when I think that I've come to the end of a book and I'm not ready to re-listen to it, I go back to this one and I just replay chapters. And again, every time I listen to it, I learn something different. And there are some provocative statements in the book that have me thinking about a new situation each time and going, huh, I'm still carrying that too. Okay, what's that about? Or even thinking about people where you have what I'll call an emotional barrier. You haven't quite forgiven somebody for what they've done, but all you're doing is carrying around a heavy weight for yourself. So you're not hurting them by not forgiving them. All you're doing is creating, just resistance to any lighter emotions that you could experience. And so letting go also spills over into the idea of forgiveness as well.
And I like this idea in your reading of having these books almost as companions. You don't need to just read them once from start to finish and then be expected to, assimilate everything. You can actually pick them up, take from them what you need, keep them with you, consult them often.
Yes, exactly. And they tell you something different each time.
Exactly. Depending on that, that day's situation or that, time of your life or whatever you may be facing when you pick them up.
Yes. So Wayne Dyer used to say, when the student is ready, mm-hmm. the teacher will appear. When you're ready to learn the lesson, suddenly the teacher is apparent. So you might listen to the same book, but you're not open to its ideas. And then you come back to it at the time when you are and you hear mm-hmm. something completely different. And you're able to apply it in such a real way. And that has been very true for me.
Sorry to bring things back to the actuarial world. But that reminds me of, when I was struggling with certain exams, the time I passed them was when I was ready to accept the information or the material that subject was trying to teach me. So it comes in various guises.
Yes, absolutely.
Can you read your favorite quote from this book?
Yeah. Everything can be taken from a man or a woman, but one thing, the last of the human freedoms to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way. So again, the power of choice. Everything can be taken from you. You could be jailed. You could be falsely accused. You could be bereft, you could be without a job, but you always have the power to choose.
Are you familiar with the work of Viktor Frankl?
Yes, I am. And it very much is along the same lines.
You have the power to choose how you react to something always. Hey?
And he's a remarkable man. I don't know that I could have been as hardy as he was in those circumstances.
But we do what we can, and I know that you're very passionate about mentoring, volunteering, coaching. Is this something you've always felt, and how would you advise maybe people in more traditional professions or actuaries to kind of pursue those interests and get involved?
It is something that I've always been involved in, and in particular once I qualified as an actuary, I just felt the need to give back in a teaching sort of way. And I volunteered to teach in a number of different places. I went to Armenia, I went to Kenya, Nigeria, Zimbabwe. And I realized that outside of the UK, it's quite difficult to make progress with the actuarial exams when you don't have the likes of acting, when you don't have the employer who's willing to fund your attempts more than once or even at all, and the support structures are very limited. So I was keen to be in places where people didn't have those advantages. I know in other parts of the world that are similar to the UK's model, including South Africa, the US, Canada, etc., it's very different. There is more support there. And so I found such a sense of fulfillment from being able to share what I knew, which helped somebody else. And the lesson that I took away from all of this is that all of us have something to teach. All of us are role models to somebody. whether we're role models to a university student, to our children, nieces and nephews, to our colleagues, our peers, in some way, the things that you do or say are impacting somebody else. And so people who don't have the time to do it formally can just recognize that every day that they're showing up somewhere, they are doing it anyway. And people who want to do it more formally can create the time and make themselves available. You don't have to go and advertise your services. You could, in the workplace, find somebody and say to them, I'd like to establish a mentoring relationship. Would you be willing? And you can have a two-way mentoring relationship, actually, and learn from the other person as well. I do know that within the profession, there are a number of opportunities to put your hand up and sign up to formal streams. I know the Actuarial Academy of East Africa has a program. I believe the IFOA and its foundation have a program. I don't know whether ASSA does, but there are definitely ways for people to say, I'd like to give back in this way, and how do I get involved?
And I think getting involved opens up a whole new network, opportunities that you might not have thought of before, these unintended benefits that, you know, just make it worthwhile.
For sure.
Even if it means stepping out of your comfort zone.
Exactly.
Okay. So the last book, I feel, is a bit of a departure from the other ones we've spoken about. And it's Dune by Frank Herbert. Can you tell us what this book is about and why you love it?
So yeah. I think in the last probably 5 or 10 years, my reading has been concentrated around personal development books. Before that, though, I was very much a fiction reader. And so this book I read more than 20 years ago at home in London. And it just really awakened something in me about the power of imagination for a start, but also the idea of relying on your own judgment and overcoming fear. And the idea that fear is in your mind and it can be conquered just stayed with me. Now, the story is powerful itself, but I think that if you're wanting to challenge your thought processes and if you're looking for growth, so it does have a personal development aspect to it as well, then the story is incredible.
What is the story? Is it a sci-fi?
It is sci-fi.
Story?
It is sci-fi. It's your usual kind of hero's tale, survival story.
Well,
but you have to use your imagination because it's set in a context that is not the bricks and mortar and streets and trees and things that we know and understand. And so you have to build a picture in your mind about what's happening and what these people look like and the gear that they use to survive and, you know, the interactions they're having. It's just, it's wonderful for the imagination. It's hard to describe.
Can you read us a favorite quote from that book?
Yes. I must not fear. Fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death that brings total obliteration. I will face my fear. I love that. Fear is the mind killer. Just so, so profound. And definitely a lesson in my life.
And it's kind of psychologically true as well, because when you have anxiety or fear, kind of shuts down your executive function.
It does.
So you can't think, you can't reason.
And fear shuts down your opportunity set. When you think you can't, or when you think you're afraid to, you shrink your world and you try and fit into the little comfortable space that you occupy. And you exclude all the things that are going to stretch you and all the things that could transform your life because you're just afraid to step into the light on the other side.
Now we can finally start talking about your book, now that we've been through all five that you've brought along today. As someone whose life goal is to write my own book, tell me about the process. How long did it take you? How painful was it?
How long did it take? So this idea, this book has been an idea in my mind forever. And so I think once I started writing it, it flowed really well. And I would say probably took me about 2 to 3 months really to get the words on paper, and then a few more weeks to just edit it and make sure that I was getting the messages across that I wanted to. Now, I had to practice my own words because I am historically a perfectionist. I want things to be the best they can be. And I had to let that go for this process because I realized that if I was looking for perfection, I was never going to publish it. If I wanted to share every single thought, idea, lesson that I've ever experienced and want to pass on, I was never going to publish it. And so I had to think carefully about, well, what are the messages that I do want to share? So I had a bit of a structure going, and you'll see from the way the book's written, I have three main sections, and within each of those, I have three chapters. And so that helped me to distill my thinking around, okay, so what are the top three things that I would share in this chapter, in this part of the book? And what are the top three things in part two, et cetera? And that helped me not run away with, well, I could say this and I could say this. And just helped me to really focus and narrow in on the key messages.
Save that for book two.
Yes, exactly.
Next volume. And, you know, one of my favorite sayings, probably the one I repeat the most at work, is done is better than perfect.
Yes. So true.
And that's probably something that every writer needs to bear in mind.
Absolutely.
So before we forget, beautiful, bright cover. Your book is called Empowered Evolution. How did you come up with the name?
A process of trial and error. And I would write titles and then I would sit with them. And then I'd come back a few days later and go, no, stop it. And then write another one. And then think, nah, not really it. And it just was an iterative process. It took me a few days to finally settle on, okay, yeah, that sounds like the book I want to write. And the title actually came after the content was written. So the tagline I was clear about because that's essentially explaining all the content. But the headline, I was going, what is this book about? What is it sharing? Well, it's sharing that it's within your gift to transform your life. That's the idea of evolving. And we're all on a growth journey. And that power and that choice belongs to you. So Empowered Evolution.
And who would you say this book is for?
It's for anyone who feels that they're looking for a what's next in their life. It's for anyone who feels that they've not truly unpacked why they're here and what they're meant to be doing with their life. And it's also for people who are busy doing and want to stop and reflect and think about, okay, so am I putting all of this effort and energy into goals that I really want? Or am I actually just living in a frivolous way? And I mean frivolous from an energetic perspective. So if your goal is to get to Kilimanjaro, but you're spending all your time in the car driving to, I don't know, Hermanus, then yeah, maybe these things are slightly misaligned. So how do you redirect your energy and your efforts to the goals that you truly want to achieve? And how do you ground that in purpose and in meaning that is specific to you and not to everything you've been taught and everything you've inherited?
And as I said before, one of the things I love about the book is how practical you make these concepts. It's a quick read. It's not, you know, a massive volume, so it shouldn't be intimidating to anyone. And at the end of each chapter, you've come up with, you know, worksheet-style exercises where people answer questions. And I believe, you know, there's further information and activities on your website.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So anyone interested in having a little sneak peek at the worksheet, you can go to aboutmarjorie.com and stick around.
Amazing. So, you know, we've spoken through all your books. I'll just recap. We spoke about A Course in Miracles by Helen Schuckman, The Courage to Be Disliked by Ishiro Kishimi and Fumitake Koga, A Fine Balance by Rohinton Mystery, Dune by Frank Herbert, and Letting Go by David Hawkins. And if I were to be very cruel and put you on a desert island where you're only allowed to bring one of these books with you, which one would it be?
Course in Miracles, because I think that that's probably the umbrella book for all the lessons I've taken away from the other one.
And I guess you're lucky that you are someone who enjoys rereading.
Yes,
so indeed. Hopefully you would never get bored.
Absolutely. And there's so much in it. And every time I read it, I interpret something different. So I don't think I would get bored with that one.
Okay. And before I let you go, I'm going to ask you a few quick fire questions about reading habits. just to see where you rank in the scheme of things. So tell me, Kindle or physical book?
Physical and audio. I can't live without the audible version.
Okay. And do you DNF or do not finish books if you're not enjoying them?
Rarely.
Same. Even though all wisdom tells us that we should.
Yes.
Do you use the Goodreads app?
Seldom.
Okay. How many books did you read last year?
Over 20.
Do you judge a book by its cover?
Sometimes.
How old do you think children should be when they learn to read?
Oh, as early as they're willing.
Okay. In fiction, do you value prose or plot?
Both. If I had to choose, it would be prose.
I was going to let that one slide, but thank you, Anne. Which book have you given as a gift most often?
The Courage to be Disliked.
And where do you get your book recommendations from?
Often from friends and sometimes from webinars I attend and somebody makes reference to a book and I think, oh, I'll look that up. And then sometimes the Audible algorithm suggests things based on my prior reading.
What's your favorite bookshop in the world?
Oh my goodness, that's so hard. Barnes & Noble. I love the combination of being able to have a nice coffee, sit somewhere comfortable, explore the store, and a bookstore with a stationery section for me is gold.
Oh, I love all the little gifts and, yes, you know, that's good that you can buy. is there a specific Barnes & Noble branch that you love?
There is one in an obscure place of the US called Deptford that I go to a fair amount in New Jersey.
And last week, what are you currently reading?
I am reading The Ultimate Jim Rohn Library. And he is somebody I'd not come across before. This was an Audible recommendation. And it's so fascinating because every now and again, I pause the book and I go, oh my goodness, that's what I said in my book. And it's just, it's incredible because he's different generation, different way of speaking, different background, similar ideas. And I'm loving it.
And I love that attitude because I think a lot of aspiring writers think, oh, I can't write that. Someone else has already written it. But, you know, there's no new story under the sun.
Exactly.
It's what you bring to the story, isn't you?
Yeah. And I don't know that there is, well, probably get vilified for saying this, but I don't know how much new knowledge there truly is. We're just connecting dots differently and we're relaying information in ways that we understand so that others may understand. So the story that I tell, and again, this was a point of imposter syndrome that I had to overcome because I kept asking myself, who wants to hear from me? And who needs another coaching book? Mm-hmm. There's so many.
Yeah.
But nobody can tell your story the way you can. And so to anyone who's thinking about writing or podcasting or blogging, nobody can say it quite like you do. And so there is value in that. And it's not about the followers or the likes or the whatever. It's about the internal desire to put your message out there. And that's what counts. And how it's received, actually, you can't control. So leave it to fate.
On that note, where can people find you if they want to follow you, buy your book, learn more about your work?
You can find me on LinkedIn, Marjorie Nguyen Coaching. You can find me on Instagram at Coach Marj, on my website aboutmarjorie.com. And you can search Empowered Evolution on Amazon to get the book. I would really love your reviews and your feedback. Even if all you do is leave me a number of stars to indicate you've read the book and your level of enjoyment, I would really appreciate them.
And we really appreciate you, Marjorie. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Pam.